Jazz, swing, blues, bop, and more from WGTD is available 24 hours a day on your desktop or laptop, smartphone or radio. To access 24/7 Jazz WGTD on your computer, go to WGTD.org. On your smartphone, download the free WGTD app. In the Kenosha Racine area, 24/7 Jazz HD2 is available via HD radio. And in the Waukegan and Pleasant Prairie areas, the service is being broadcast temporarily over analog radio at 103.3 FM. For more information, call 262-564-3030.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, Chuck Wolbers, a special education teacher with Kenosha Unified Successful Transitions for Exceptional Students Program, and Steve Brown, assistant professor of educational leadership at UW Oshkosh. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Good morning and welcome to Education Matters. My name is Mike Kehoe. I'm your host for this week. And we have a couple of guests with us, and I'll ask them each to introduce themselves.
I'm Mary Wagner. I'm a circuit court judge in Kenosha Circuit Courts and have been doing so since 1991.
And my name is Eitan Benzikin, and I work for Kenosha Unified School District. I'm the principal of Hillcrest, an alternative education school, as well as the principal for Phoenix Project, which is a school that is located in our county detention center.
And again, my name is Mike Kehoe. I am, in addition to the host of this program, I am a special education support person over at Bullen Middle School. And I am a former attorney. I practiced law for 30 years. And Judge Wagner, you were a teacher as well.
Yes. When I graduated from the University of Wisconsin in Madison, I was hired to teach at Bristol Consolidated Schools, and I taught for 5.5 years, fourth grade, and I loved it.
And Eitan, you're what you do over at Hillcrest, the marvelous work you do over at Hillcrest, is very much involved with the legal system.
Oh yeah,
correct. Because the majority of your students are involved in the court system. Is that correct?
Yeah, we have actually a great thing set up over at Hillcrest and the Phoenix Project. But at Hillcrest, we have a partnership that was created long before I was there between community impact programs and DCFS, the Department of Family and Children's Services, and actually they fund some of the staff that are at Hillcrest. So it's not just KUSD staff, it's KUSD staff and these community impact programs that are all housed out of the school. So it leads to a real wraparound services of the students that attend as well as their families, so that we can prepare and plan for how we're going to help them and aid them through moments of crisis or through things together, both at school and at home.
Okay, and I will add to that I was an active foster parent for 20-some years with Kenosha Human Development Services, and had several of my foster kids were placed there through our program. Our placements were a minimum of 6 months long usually, and all of the kids that we dealt with were in the legal system. And so maybe folks are beginning to, I didn't say past foster parent, by the way. My folks were foster parents, and one of the first things that I learned, the first thing they told me when I was thinking of becoming a foster parent, is that there's no such thing as a foster parent, so understand this before you get in, mm-hmm. because your kids are still out there, and no matter how old they are, So that's just, it's something like being a Marine, you know. You're always a Marine. You're always a foster parent.
I was going to add something to this part. One of the things that has happened over my many years of being in the courts is that the programs that the Department of Social Services works with and the schools have really tried to shift to pre-court involvement, that to intercede before they come to the court, because evidence research says that it's much more important to provide the services before they get tied up into the court system. And that has really been a shift in all these years. So they might not have legal cases. The school and the department work together to decide that this child could really benefit through this intensive service. And I think that's been an excellent shift.
Yeah, that's a good point. We at Hillcrest probably have a higher amount of students that are in the within the system. However, they have staff, community impact workers at each of the schools, each of the secondary schools, each of the high school, to do that preventive work around students that may be close to being involved in the court system but aren't yet, and really trying to divert those kids away from the court system and into some healthier practices in life.
Yeah, and maybe folks are trying to see are seeing now that how this conversation between the three of us came to be is because we're all involved in the same sort of thing. That's also I see those people over at Bullen. They are working very much with the kids that I'm working with at least some of them, and I'm there to be a mentor, someone other than a teacher, who can help them with their work, help them with their social adjustment, and that they can come to with problems that they would not come to a teacher with, especially the boys, because I'm the only person at Bullen who is a male who's in the special ed field. And when you're dealing with early adolescent and pre-adolescent boys, there are a lot of things they won't talk to a female teacher about. But recently, I've been asked to present for Career Day and things like that, presentations about law. And I was kind of surprised by the questions I got from kids, which we used to get, can you be touched by a teacher? Can your locker be searched? Stuff like that. Now they're asking some pretty sophisticated questions about how the legal system and the school system relate to one another. And this past weekend, I was talking to my friend Dr. Rarick, a psychiatrist who knows what I do and knows that I was family court commissioner. And he asked me, how do you all balance the different standards, the best interest of the child, the least restrictive alternative, and being an advocate for children? How do you manage all that and manage to balance it? Anybody have any thoughts on it? Because one answer is that we all work together, the different systems, but how do we do it?
You do it case by case. You have to look at the circumstances and the surroundings of each child to say what is in this child's best interest. It's different applications when you're talking about removing a child from a home, when you're deciding about replacing the child back in the home, when you're deciding whether or not the parental rights should be terminated. I mean, those are, yes, it's all in the best interest, and it matters what age they are and the surroundings of their circumstances. There's lots of complicating factors that come into when we talk about best interest. And when you talk about that to the court, you're talking about having to make decisions. I think it's a little different when you're talking about a school system and saying what is in our children's best interest as we design curriculums, and I would let you talk about that.
I would probably echo what you're saying is that to help with the advocacy work that we're all doing around the table, and We all come together with the idea and the goal of what is going to help the child the most. And as long as we kind of stay focused on what we think would be helpful for the child, it usually the decisions get easier, you know, whether it's, like you said, removal, or whether it's doing something that the child or the family doesn't appreciate at that moment. If you know that you're acting on the in the best interest of the student or the kid, it makes those decisions, you know, in the long run, you're doing what's best. You know, they're tough to go through, but it ends up you're helping out a lot of kids.
And keeping up on the most current research is critical. I mean, if you go back to the history of education, we had schools in Wisconsin that took Indian children, Native American children, out of their homes and placed them in schools so that they would learn English. We know that that was a damaging thing to do culturally. And then we had orphanages for children who were abused or neglected. We had trains that moved children from the East Coast out to farms in the plains during the Depression. We know all those things were quite harmful in looking back. And so it's important to keep up with the research about when, from court's perspective, when can families survive? When can they work through issues for the best interest of children, even though they may not be, you know, how I was raised. But this child in this circumstance, what's best? And the research shows lots of things about that.
I think research can help us out a lot. We do a ton of work there as far as keeping up to date, as far as what... We almost call it better practices rather than best practices, because we've known that as years progress, we've learned better and better practices. And we've also learned that continual work on better practices also continues to make you better. So every staff member at Hillcrest, at the Phoenix Project, goes to conferences every single year and then comes back and shares out and teaches. We also have trainings within the school and within the district on trauma-informed care, on health care, mental health care, and that's every single year, on self-care, because those kinds of things are needed in order for the system to be functional and at its best.
You know, what's the name of the program that's installed into the school system now, the positive behavioral. Tell us about that. That is, I have sat through presentations on that. I love that idea.
So positive behavior intervention systems, or support, some people say, is really it was a shift of mentality or philosophy from going with consequences, where if the student didn't do something, then the whole system worked on consequences to get that student to do it. If they didn't sit in their seats, they might be referred to a principal, they might get detention, they might get suspension. It was all kind of negative oriented. And PBIS really lends itself to how can we build a system where we can do a couple things. One is teach the students what we want to see, and then reward them for doing what we're expecting. And that really makes it a more positive atmosphere leads to much greater students actually going out and doing the things you want them to expect. So it's much easier on the whole system, as far as it's always easier to recognize and reward another human being than it is to punish or be punitive on a human level. So it really transforms schools from kind of a negative atmosphere to a positive one.
At the middle schools, we have a PBIS element at the beginning of the day, a couple of days a week, and there's a coordinator for each school. That's going to be somewhat subjective, I would think, depending on how enthusiastic the coordinator for that school is. Is there a coordinator at the higher level? working with that?
There's coordination throughout the system. There's district and site-based coordination, but I think that once the staff really sees the changes, also what's a great component is that it's data-driven. So you look at the data that the referrals that are coming out, what your students are not doing well on, and then you teach that expectation in a positive way. I think a lot of staff really buy into it because after a while they see, listen, we're doing something about students that are acting inappropriately, but we're doing it in a positive way. So it helps the whole system. And then that leads to kind of a ground up movement instead of a kind of bottom down.
And I think, does PBIS come out of DPI? I mean, Department of Public Instruction. It's an effort throughout the state.
Oh,
it's not just Kenosha. And as I understand it, when you asked about the coordinators, there is a significant training component, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, yeah.
For these coordinators, and they filtered it in over the last 3 or 4 years into a school here and a school where they thought they could implement it, the best in the beginning. And I don't know how many schools it's in now, but I assume it's spreading.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. You're on point.
With regard to the point you raised, Judge, about changes in approaches, I was thinking of a situation in my own family. My sister, who died 2 years ago, who was profoundly autistic, when she was young, on the advice of a physician, she went to the University of Wisconsin Hospitals in Madison and was evaluated. And they came back with a recommendation based on the theory of that time that those children were being deprived of affection and stuff like this. And the refrigerator moms is the concept that the acronym by which it became known.
What, and cold, inhumane parenting?
Right. And they made some recommendations from that. Fortunately, our next door neighbor was a wonderfully talented physician, family physician, and he just went ballistic when he heard that. He thought that was just so ridiculous, but it caused an enormous amount of trauma for my mother because it was pointing the finger at blame. And then they went from that to segregation of kids with Down syndrome and autism, first not being allowed in school. Secondly, they started creating specialty segregated schools to deal with them,
which we called special schools.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then they went to the colony system, which is then that got a bad, was not politically correct. They quickly changed that to centers, and there were three centers around the state, and now we're back to working with them in the school setting in inclusion as much as possible. If the problem is more profound, group homes. But it's an example to me of how we're learning so much about behavioral issues and medical issues, and how we have to be flexible. And I guess the thing that I started this comment with was these changes come about because of folks like you who are working with the kids and the feedback that comes back from them. And would you say that's the case, that the people who are inventing programs, inventing approaches, are paying enough attention to the people who are actually working with the individuals?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah, and do you see... you might also see, you guys see that maybe also in a non-school setting, maybe the grocery store, for example, you've seen
the work
evolution
site.
Of people with disabilities also and at-risk people.
Being absorbed into the community. One, you're talking about learning from our experiences. In the jail, we have the Living Free program, and it is marvelous. Now, I don't have any statistics. I don't know that they've kept the record necessary to say recidivism is reduced and so on. But I can tell you that in my experience in people that come into court on criminal cases who have gone through the Living Free program, and it's an educational program on a variety of life issues, really, I'd say, including, you know, learning how to apply for jobs and things like that, that when they talk about living free, their demeanor changes, very few of them, no, none of them that have completed it have told me they thought it was a waste of their time. If they're appointed a mentor afterwards to help the other inmates with the lessons and the process, they are so proud of themselves. And they really say, I really learned a lot. And that's the learning that's necessary. And some of those people are quite young. I mean, they can be 18 and 19 and so on. So I think we learn from the people that are around us and what we see they need. You know, when I started, I don't think the jail would ever have considered having such a program among its inmates. And you talked about the Phoenix program, mm-hmm. and that's part of the jail process now, too. So
yeah, we definitely see the positive impacts of Living Free in our students at the Phoenix Project. It's absolutely amazing. As well as, like you were saying, Mike, that students with disabilities, students at risk, I think in general, you see, I think that the community has really rallied around around that population, around those populations, and really care for them. I think that was significant throughout the course of history that people have cared for. But now there's opportunities made available so that we can include and integrate people that are having difficulties into our communities and into our schools in a positive way, which leads again to kind of that synergy of having students that and people around that are again if I've been included and I'm a person with disability and you've been with me throughout our educational career, when we do go to the grocery store, you're not as apprehensive and I'm not as apprehensive. We're comfortable being around each other. Which leads to us taking the next generation and going forward even more so with that that idea. And so I get very excited when I hear and I'm around the table with advocates for people for people with disabilities or for people that are at risk, people that children, advocates like you guys. I really do appreciate what you're doing.
That's why I love the public school. It's inclusion. Kids are exposed to all kinds of different people, which is what makes up our world. And they have to know that. And I think the public schools of Kenosha do such a marvelous job of making sure that kids have lots of opportunities, lots of experiences. I'm impressed. Kenosha News... every day, practically, there's a story about some success in the school system of the sports sometimes, but academic and, you know, competitive things that they participate in around the state. We have a great school system, and we don't hear it enough. And I really love what you do at Hillcrest. You know that. So,
And at this point here, I should probably say something about mentoring also, because that is something that has really grown, and that's what I'm involved in, and I get so much satisfaction out of it that I do it full time. I'm amazed at how much of an effect it has on certain kids. You know, you can't evaluate something like that on a macroscopic way very well without having an awful lot of data. But I can look at the kids on my caseload and every year see some of them that maybe made no change in direction for them whatsoever, but others that were made very significant changes in their behavior, in their attitude towards learning, in their love of reading, just because they were around somebody who was informal that they could talk to, who enjoyed reading, who could help them with math and explain math to them
in a calm and encouraging manner.
Yes. Because I have so much more time to spend with these kids. These are kids that are referred to me by teachers who say, this kid really could benefit from something, and I don't have enough time to do it. And we're basically filling in for maybe something that's missing from the rest of their environment, from home or something.
Yeah, on a macro level, we know that you know, a lot of the students that are at risk, whether they have had unreliable or unpredictable home lives and parents. We also know from the research that even one person that cares about you, your chances of going into the of being incarcerated goes down dramatically. Just from one person. So that mentoring, that connection of one person caring about me and being there in a consistent manner helps. And obviously on a micro level, we see that, you know, at Hillcrest, we have firefighters that come in every single week, every Monday, and students that they mentor every single week, every single Monday. And again, that relationship is bonded and formed, and because it's consistent and because it's a caring person who doesn't have any extrinsic motivation. It's just, I'm here to care about you. And the student gets that. And once that connects, that student feels valued and feels like their life has meaning and some value to it. So it's very, very powerful. I'd encourage anybody who has the time to help mentor.
And CABA, I believe, runs a mentoring program, mm-hmm. Kenosha Area Business Association.
Boys and Girls Club, too.
And the Boys and Girls. And the research, there is research about mentoring, Mike, and it does show that it makes such an impact in the lives of these kids. It's one of the most successful. I think it is the most successful program. It makes a kid feel that they're included in the community. You know, if you've been excluded because, you know, everything kind of goes wrong in your house, and your choices every day are very challenging, and all of a sudden a regular person who wants to help you is interested in how are you doing today. That's the boys. We used to have Big Brothers, Big Sisters years ago, or Kinship. Was it Kinship or Big Brothers, Big Sisters? I think maybe we had both in the old days. But those programs really make an impact.
For so many of those kids, they don't trust any adults. If they have an experience that there's with an adult in their life that they can trust to be fair with them, to care about them, to be there for them. Be interested in whatever, and that's the key. If you can turn that key and they get to trust you, you have a big barrier drops, and suddenly then you can work on academics and social behavior and what's going through the things you go through when you start becoming a teenager and so on. But the trust has to be there, and they expect certain kinds of responses to what they do. And if they don't get those responses, they get something else. Like if they go to Hillcrest and their behavior tests that they put you through result in something other than they expected, which was punishment, get rid of this kid,
exclusion.
Anger, exclusion. Mm-hmm. And instead, your people, and I've subbed there a lot, and no matter what these kids do, next day they come back, and they're welcome back, and
it's a new day. It's a new day.
Yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, the whole system is founded on the idea of needs first. So when a kid comes angry or calls us a name or does almost anything, the first thing we start off is what's going on? What's going on at home? What's going on with you? What's going on? Are you upset about something else? We're not talking about what you're doing to us. We're talking about what the problem is. Once we've de-escalated and gotten to the actual problem, and the student and the kid feels better, then we can circle back around. Well, maybe there was a better way of handling that. If you come at it, oftentimes the mistake with trauma students or with mental health students, with even kids that have drug and alcohol issues, is that you're trying to tackle the reaction before you tackle the problem. And it really needs to be the other way around.
One of the things that I think the public should understand is the very complex nature of children that are walking through the door every morning. Some on time, some late, some not there and have to be, they have to go to their house and try to get them there. Some of our kids live in very raucous circumstances. They're victims of sexual abuse, and they can't tell anybody, or they think they can't tell anybody. They live through violent domestic abuse incidences the night before they come to school, and they have to hide in the closet or put the pillow over their head and try not to hear it and not to listen, or intervene and then get some themselves. They have mentally ill parent or parents, or drug and alcohol affected parents, or people that are living in their house who aren't their parents, who abuse or mistreat children. And the teachers face these kids every single day, the teachers and the administrators and the staff, but they're brought into their classroom, and the teachers have to deal with those challenges that those kids have. And we know that like 90% of, better than 90, of the women that go to prison have been sexually abused or misused. The men, the last statistic I saw, which was quite a few years ago, was about 75%. And they thought that that number was lower because they weren't as willing to disclose about things that had happened. Well, you know, they'll say nothing happened. But that is a big issue for kids in our community and in our country, I think. It's not just here. And I think that the schools accept those kids and wrap their arms around them and try to get life to be a little bit more calm for them, at least while they're with them. And they do a marvelous job.
Yeah, the perception or the understanding of who's coming to the door or who you're working with is really difficult, because almost always the staff or the person in the community are not having those experiences and may have not gone through those experiences. Even trying to understand what those experiences are like without going through them is a difficult situation. It's not a conscious thing. It's more of a reflection that has to be built into the system, whether it's trainings for trauma or trainings around mental health, but really an active, actively bringing back the idea of who we're interacting with. I'll give you a quick scenario that happened to me. You know, oftentimes I would drive to central office and I'd see some of my students in the streets or walking along. And I, at first, was wondering, I don't have that many students in KUSD. I probably have less than 1% of KUSD. There's 22,000 kids. I maybe have 100, 120. I was wondering why I saw so many of my own kids out there. And one of the things that, after exploring that reflection, was that a huge segment of the 22,000 kids actually go to school every day. They're not out on the street ever. And then another big population, when they're out, they have someone to care for them. They're at home getting better, or they're at a home or on a vacation. There's a reason that they're out of school. It's usually the kids that are at risk that don't have that person that cares for them and don't have the means of transportation and don't that are more likely to be on the street and walking around. And that's why I see more of my kids than I probably should. But that reflection led me to understand that I have to keep knowledgeable, and I have to keep thinking of it from another person's point of view, and that is from a tougher point of view, from people that are either marginalized or people that are going through difficult times, like Judge Wagner said. That doesn't happen instantaneously, and that doesn't happen naturally to a human being that hasn't had those experiences.
I have a story. When I became a teacher, my mother had been principal of Hillcrest School, but it wasn't yours. It was the old Hillcrest School that was sort of on the edge of Summers, and it was public school. And she said that one day this little girl came to school and she just wasn't behaving. It was so odd and so strange. And she said, so I was getting after her a little bit. And finally she said, I said to her, what is the matter? Why are you doing this? And she said, well, it was during the war. And she said, well, the government came to the door. I think they sent military people to the door. And they told us, my brother is dead. And, she was all set to go to school, so off she went to school. And so the point my mother made to me as I began my teaching career is, you never know what a kid is thinking or what they've experienced before they walk in the door. And don't ever forget that. And I have never forgotten that. So, I mean, and that was a tragedy of a nice little girl that had a experience.
Yeah, I just recently, one of the workers, they do a summer youth employment program here in Kenosha, and it's amazing how Kenosha community really rallies around students at risk. This is a program where kids can get a job, at-risk kids can get a job during the summer, paid. You see all kinds of crime rate go down, and also they get the resources that they need, but they have to do interviews for this. And one of the students was interviewing with a CIP worker, and the CIP worker asked, well, why do you want this job? What are you looking for? And the student said, well, I'm really trying to get the job so I can pay for a tombstone for my father. And that really kind of choked him up, and, again, adds to the understanding that we don't understand. We don't know what they're coming to us with and what they're going through, but we're open to to listening and being part of the solution when they've trusted us enough to tell us what's going on.
Yeah, I think as you were talking, I was thinking of the three P's of police work: patience, persistence, and procedure. Patience is so important. People expect us to achieve results very quickly, and you can't. One of the things I like about what I'm doing is I start with, I have some seventh graders and I have some eighth graders, and the seventh graders I will stay with into eighth grade, and that doesn't happen in any other section of middle school. They'll have different special ed teachers next year, but I'll still be there for them, and so there's a continuity there. And it shows, you mentioned someone saying hello to you. One of the most satisfying things that happens to me is if I'm walking through a parking lot at a grocery store or something and some kid will say hello to me, maybe that I had 2-3 years ago. it shows that you've made a connection. And once you've done that, as I said before, all sorts of doors open for you. Another thing is the motivation of people who do what we do to be effective. It has to be important to us. I mean, we have to realize the importance of it. We have to realize that we're kind of responsible for other people. Of the foster kids that I had over the 22 years that I was in foster parenting, two of them committed suicide before they were 30. That probably is something in the back of my head that motivates me to continue doing what I'm doing. But it makes me, with every kid that I work with, to realize that whatever behaviors he or she may be showing, or whatever academic progress he or she may not be making, may be due to something else that is going to be very profound in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. It's big challenges. But I am extremely proud of the efforts that Unified and the Department of Social Services make in, when we started, talk about wrapping around services that will make kids successful in their own way. And that's an important goal.
We have 3.5 minutes left. Is there anything that either of you would like to say that we or talk about that we haven't covered before we sign off here?
I think it's important for the community to understand when I talk about the department and the school system and their efforts that they make to put complete programs together, this is all with the cooperation of the administration of the public school systems and the County Department of Social Services, County Executive Cruiser, and the County Board. And I think that that over the years, our county board and our county administration has grown remarkably in the understanding of the importance of a safe community, a successful community, economically developing community, and how important all these things fit together.
Just a call out to advocacy that if you feel like, even if you feel like you don't know a lot, or you're not very well trained, oftentimes that students with at-risk students need someone. And if you're willing to care and you're willing to really be in someone's life, that's all that is important. And just get involved, like we said throughout the program. You know, whether it's call Kenosha Unified, Hillcrest, Boys and Girls Club, DCFS, there's opportunities to mentor and to, you know, get involved. And you will help a life. It's not glamorous. It's not looking for money, but you'll be able to help another human being go through their life that is struggling. And that's powerful, I think.
I think of it sometimes kind of as a chemical reaction. You can do a chemical analysis on a piece of paper and a formula, and you can kind of predict what the outcome is going to be, or a range of outcomes. And when you're dealing with young people who have a lot of risk factors, what you can do is you can change the equation by adding an additional element. Mm-hmm. An additional person and a different attitude that's going to maybe make a very profound difference. So that brings us to the end of our program. Please tune us in again next week. If you know of someone who would like to have an interest in this program and has been unable to hear our broadcast this morning, they can go to WGTD.org and the program will be archived there. Don't know who will be here next week or what the subject will be. We're redoing our schedule, but please join us. Thank you.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. and you're invited to continue the discussion on the education